We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
You are entering the news vault from KCBS Radio.
Flames and the smoke.
I have a tape recorder here in my hand.
Now nobody would think of doing that.
The newsmen were blocking the door.
It worked for a couple of seconds.
Bringing the sounds of history back to life. Here is your host, Stan Bunger.
And this time we'll introduce you to a long silent name from the past of KCBS Radio. His name was Al Douglas. And in the early to mid-1960s, he was well known on the radio station. Let's go ahead and read an excerpt from a profile on Al Douglas done by the Marin Independent Journal in June of 1964. A simple description of the program would be misleading because Al's routine does not fit into easy categories. His guest list is as likely to include a Shakespearean scholar as a flying saucer enthusiast, and his conversation may begin with nuclear fission and end up with deep water fishing. Or he may devote the entire evening to some special project, as was the case last month when he brought together the two leading opponents in the Northern California pay TV controversy. He was, by the way, the first to get representatives from both sides to appear at the same time. However, the scholarly ex-sports director does have some regular features. Most frequent are his conversations with visiting and local personalities. On Viewpoint, he invites the radio audience to call in and express opinions on such topics as what's happening to our mortality or the new trend in our relations with Russia. He ends his day with the news and sports at 11 p.m., but Al applies his own particular brand of talent most successfully to the 8:30 to 10 spot called, appropriately enough, An Evening with Al Douglas. Being a conscientious host, Al channels all his energy toward preparing features and interviews which cause his listeners to feel that they have, in fact, spent the evening as his special guest. One night a week, he reads a short story for his True Tales of the West feature. And twice a week, he spotlights travels with the Douglases, suggestions for family trips in California and San Francisco. One of Al's most popular features is The Story Behind the Song, during which he reads a letter from one of his listeners relating a personal story associated with the listener's favorite song. Again, from the Marin Independent Journal, a profile published in June of 1964. This segment of Al Douglas's work on KCBS comes from November of 1963 and is courtesy of the California Historical Radio Society Bay Area Radio Museum collection. He interviews the legendary photographer Ansel Adams. It aired on KCBS in November of 1963.
Tonight, we're very privileged indeed to have as one of our guests, Mr. Ansel Adams. And Mr. Adams, an outstanding photographer. As a matter of fact, from now through December 8th, you can see some of the works of Ansel Adams in an exhibit at the DeYoung Museum entitled Ansel Adams, 40 Years of Photography, over at the DeYoung Museum. When we speak of 40 years of photography, Mr. Adams, are we literally correct? Are we showing some of your earliest works that were made 40 years ago?
Yes, some 1923.
Now tell us about the 1923 pictures.
Well, I go back a few years before that and say that I had a box brownie, a 2¼, 2¼ in Yosemite in 1916.
Mm-hmm.
And
what could you see with a box brownie?
Well,
you're talking about the grandeur of nature, and you're in Yosemite. You've got yourself a $2.50 camera. What can you do with it?
Well, I got a few very good images with it, but of course, I know I was only 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
This was 1916. And then I think the next adventure was a Best Pocket Kodak, which was even smaller. And then I returned in 1917, and in my 1918, I was really excited and had an old view camera. And I was studying music at the time, and I spent my summers in the mountains, and everybody who goes to the mountains usually photographs. And I was bitten very badly by the bug.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1923, I had a graduated to a 6½, 8½ plate camera.
Mr. Adams, I understand from reading material about you that it was quite a choice that you had to make, that you did have a real start in music. and that you were considered by many quite good and quite adaptable and could easily have had a future in music. Did you feel that strongly about your music at the time you made your decision, or as you said, I got the bug?
Well, yes, it was difficult, and I think the final decision wasn't made immediately. I thought for a while I could do both,
mm-hmm.
and then that was proved to be impossible, and I would say about 1932 I had made a definite decision to be a professional photographer.
When you say a professional photographer as such, Mr. Adams, are we talking about making it one's life's work and being able to make a living as a result of practicing photography?
Yes, I think in photography we use the term amateur in the sense of a person who loves the medium but does not have to make his living. And some of the greatest photographers have been amateurs,
mm-hmm.
in that sense of the term. The professional is somebody who professes photography as a career, as a way of living.
But did you feel there was a market for the kind of thing you want to do? I understand your first efforts were definitely pictures in nature. Some of the things you did at Yosemite and in the Sierra are highly prized today.
Well,
what kind of market do we have for that kind of photography?
I did not have too much actual market until about 1930.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, in 1927, Albert Bender, a great art patron here, encouraged me to do a portfolio of prints, 18 prints. And he was a philanthropist and got all his friends to buy it, and it was quite a fantastic procedure, $50 a set. And it's about 2 hours, he sold enough to pay for the whole project.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gave me things to do, copying works of art and some portraiture. And so I really began making a little money out of music in the 1927-28.
How much help was that to you? Could you have survived without this patron at that particular time?
Well, nobody knows that. I don't think I would have gotten into photography if it hadn't been for him. Kind of an interlocking chain of events.
Well, what did he see? Did he intellectualize this? How did he feel about photography?
He just liked to help young people, and he did an enormous amount of good for people in a very wonderful and a non-destructive way.
Mm-hmm.
It was a real philanthropic point of view. He'd rather give somebody a specific job for some purpose and than just give them money, you know.
Well, isn't that a rare thing, especially in you could almost call it an infant art photography, to have someone become a sponsor?
Well, Albert Bender was a very rare person, and I think, as I say, if it hadn't been for him, I well might have continued the music. But those things are impossible to say.
You know, we had a photographer here the other day. We were talking to Phil Palmer. And I was challenging Mr. Palmer, as I suppose I'm about to challenge you, about the mechanical aspects of photography as compared to what people would assume to be a great art and creative force in, say, painting. Mr. Palmer became quite eloquent on his love for photography and what it meant, and I'm sure you feel equally as strong. How about the charge that this is too mechanical to ever really be thought of in terms of a great painting that hangs in the museum?
I used to get it from my friends who were very unhappy about me leaving music.
I knew this was a question, a sophomore type question, but go ahead.
No, but they would say, how can a mechanical device such as a camera express the human soul?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, Stieglitz proved that doesn't make a bit of difference what instrument you use. If there's a soul to express, it can be expressed. But I think the average person does not realize the steps in the production of a photograph. And if you want, I'll try to simplify.
You'll have to. You're talking to me, you call.
I would say that the artist in photography is always in a condition of making a photograph. And it's an inherent desire. Everything he looks in the world, it's instinctive or intuitive, but he sees it perhaps as a picture. In some way, he'll organize things in space. And not as a painter does, but just noticing the actual relationships of shapes and masses and scale, and then then establishes a point of view where those shapes, or what we call configurations and chaos, become organized. And all this is a highly intuitive process, at least as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
So so I then have, as I said, we have first the continuous desire to see and to photograph. Then we experience a kind of recognition of some possibility. And then we start visualizing the final picture, trying to see it as it will be finished.
Mm-hmm.
And we establish the point of view and determine the exposure and the related development. And we then have our, we call our negative.
Well, this brings an interesting point to me. You talk about seeing it, for lack of a better expression, in your mind's eye, as it will be. How many times will you have to look at a particular thing or retake the photograph before you're satisfied that you've got that picture you want?
Well, I think that any retake very rarely happens. I think
it doesn't. It's interesting.
If you know your work and you know your techniques, you get it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have to retake and fuss with it, that's almost a proof that you won't get anything.
Have you ever had that situation?
Oh, yes. I've made many failures.
Mm-hmm.
But I never...
Is that the first basis for a failure, yeah, the fact that you... do you feel you're on the verge of failure the moment you have to retake it?
Yes, if I have any sense of uncertainty,
mm-hmm,
then I feel that it's going to be a failure for me. Now, there are some photographers, especially the big illustrative people, who, of course, the greater part of their work is the actual arrangement or contrivance of objects. Advertising photographs, and some of course, extremely beautiful. But it seems to me that in many cases... the art quality or the aesthetic quality exists in the arrangement, and the camera then merely records.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different thing.
Well, in photographing a subject in nature as they stand, mm-hmm, your works that have received so much attention in the Yosemite, what do you wait for in terms of light and so forth, since the object is never moving, or it is pretty constant in that sense?
Well, actually, things are always changing. And some people will wait. I never be patient enough to wait, because I agree with Edward Weston that if I waited too long here, I lost something over there that might be better.
Mm-hmm.
So many of my photographs, which I consider my best ones, were... I almost lost them. It's a matter of time, just mm-hmm, a few seconds.
What would you have lost in those few seconds?
Well, I just would have lost the subject would have changed, and the visualization... the first visualization would have gone, and perhaps the second one wouldn't have appeared, you see.
How many people do understand the nuances of what we're talking about? Or do people just take a look and say, gee, that's a pretty mountain?
Well, I think that the majority of people do that, and that's what Coleridge spoke of when he said that all art was a combination of the external and the internal. And so I call the scene as the external event. And then the picture of the scene is my internal event. And the same mountain could be poorly photographed, and a mountaineer might be interested as a factual record.
Yes.
But the point is, it would most certainly would not have a profound emotional effect that a very fine image can produce. And, of course, Edward Weston proved that many years ago in his photographs of Point Lobos, wonderful rocks, and about the first time that any revelation in nature of that kind had been made. Well, not exactly. I'm not historically correct, but at least it was the most important work.
We have been talking by way of recording tonight to Ansel Adams, whose 40 years of photography is currently on exhibit at the de Young Museum and will be on exhibit through December the 8th. I think it's important we get the hours that the museum is open, so...
It's 10 to 5.
10 to 5. Thank you, Mr. Adams. We'll be talking to Mr. Adams.
7 days a week.
Right, 7 days a week. We'll be talking to Mr. Adams by way of recording later in the week. Currently on exhibit at the de Young Museum in San Francisco, an outstanding group of photographs by Ansel Adams, in which 40 years of this artist's work is on display, or representative pieces of his work are on display. And when I say representative pieces, am I correct? How many do we have on display, Mr.
There's
Adams?
About 454.
Could you possibly give us any idea of how many photographs you've taken in this 40-year period we're talking about?
Well, I have in my vault over 17,000 cataloged and somewhere between 5,000 and 8,000 uncataloged. And I'm sorry to say that I have many negatives, some very fine ones that have yet to be printed.
Mm-hmm.
I never could catch up with my printing.
Do you know, can you recall, even though you don't have them cataloged, what you have taken and what pictures to your mind?
Well, I might have some difficulty in remembering all of the stuff. Oh, I can go into the catalog and think up duplicates and near duplicates of related pictures. Mm-hmm. But the instant I see a negative, I usually can recreate the whole process and have no trouble at all in revisualizing the print that I want.
All right. Now, in terms of printing, Mr. Adams, I assume you do all your own printing. How important is the print? I suppose to me it is the most important thing because this is what I see. In relation to you, how much time do you put in technically to get that print?
Oh, well, that is a very varying... I don't know how to classify the divisions of time. I mean, sometimes mm-hmm. you work very fast. Sometimes a print can be a very obdurate object, if I can use the term.
Mm-hmm.
And you work without a result. Finally, you get it, or think you get it. And then when the print is finally dry, you are disappointed with it. You haven't got your tonal levels that you desired, because the print, of course, changes very much from its wet condition
mm-hmm.
in the darkroom to its dry condition when mounted.
Would you allow anyone else to develop your pictures, Mr. Adams, or couldn't it be done that way?
No, anybody who has worked out the technique along my own, what I call the zone system approach, and was a good, safe craftsman, could develop my negatives on simple instruction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, knowing what my developer was and knowing what normal, a normal minus, a normal plus development meant.
Yes.
So I insist quite often have entrusted my negatives to other people with perfectly good result.
Mr. Adams, how much
have
you done? Yes, in terms of very large mural type effects.
Well,
when you're talking about the grandeur of nature, I assume this lends itself pretty well to very large presentations, does it not?
Yeah, you'll see some out at the museum. Mm-hmm. 40 by 60 inches,
mm-hmm.
40 by 70 inches.
Technically, how is a 40 by 70 inch print made?
Oh, that's easy. The paper, of course, comes in rolls.
Mm-hmm.
I don't you call them photo murals. That's a very bad word anyway. It means a photograph is pasted on the wall. Most of them are very poor quality. The problem is to get a large print which is conceived on what we might call a concept of a large image. Now, sometimes I have many of my older photographs which do lend themselves, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes a photograph that is perfectly beautiful in 8 by 10 is not good even in 1620.
Mm-hmm.
The paper comes, as I said, in rolls, and the fine, high-quality paper comes in about 40-inch width. So I have a simple easel, vertical easel, and I just roll down the paper like you pull down a window blind.
Mm-hmm.
And the easel is metal, so the paper is held on by magnets, and then the section is trimmed off, and the picture is exposed, just like an ordinary enlargement.
Are there any limits to how large a photograph can be blown up, to your knowledge?
Well, no, you can go to any size you want in sections. I mean, I've made photographs as much as 12 sections.
Mm-hmm.
But the aesthetic quality, of course, is something else.
By that, you mean the smaller a print, the sharper it will be?
Well, there's really an appropriate size. And when you get enlarged, when you have a negative enlarged over a certain, how would I put it? If you enlarge a negative, we'll say so many linear diameters,
mm-hmm.
It may hold at just the equivalent of reading distance.
I see.
Up to a certain size. Then it begins to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it at a greater distance, it'll pull itself together again. So you theoretically, I suppose, could have a 100 by 200 foot photograph, and if you could see it from a sufficient distance, it might be extremely impressive.
Mr. Adams, many times painters are commissioned to put murals in public buildings and so forth. How are fine photographers like yourself doing in this direction? Are any public buildings, to your knowledge, state buildings, asking for photographic murals rather than a hand-painted object?
No, not that I know of. There's lots of commercial murals done. But just before the war, I was appointed, World War II, I was appointed photomuralist for the Department of the Interior.
Yes.
And I started out on... It was a big project, and then the war killed that.
Well, how much work had you done before the...
I just made some negatives. I never gotten into the enlarged stage.
What was the purpose? Were you going to help decorate some of the government buildings?
Secretary Ickes wanted photographs, creative photographs of the national parks in the interior building.
Mm-hmm.
There were some rather dreadful paintings the WPA period. Some workers at that period were very fine, but these were fairly dismal.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that... an exciting photograph would have more meaning.
Did he see any of your work?
Oh, yes.
Was he enthused about the project after seeing it?
He was very understanding and very, very enthused. But obviously, with the war on, it was...
Have you ever tried to reinstitute the idea?
No. After the war, then, there was some troubles. You know, I think Ickes resigned and the project died.
Mm-hmm.
But I had then a Guggenheim Fellowship, which carried it on, but not with the mural intention.
What does the Guggenheim Fellowship mean to you, Mr. Adams, in terms of your work?
Well, it was extremely important. It's a big boost to begin with, mm-hmm. a great honor.
Had this been awarded to photographers before?
Edward Weston got the first one.
I see.
And I forget when where I came in. I came in as one of the early fellows in photography.
Yes.
And I've had three. One, and then a renewal, and then another fellowship. In fact, I'm still finishing that third one. And it's...
But it is unusual, though, for a photographer to achieve a Guggenheim Fellow.
Well, relatively so, but Dorothea Lange and Brett Weston, John Schakowsky, who's now director of photography at the Museum of Modern Art,
mm-hmm.
And quite a few others have. I think there was two given this last year. It's usually one.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking about 40 years of photography for Ansel Adams. What has happened to photography in 40 years? Could you... summarize it in your own mind?
Well, I'm going to quote a marvelous statement by Charles Sheeler, who was a great photographer and one of our great painters. And we were looking at a historical show at the Museum of Modern Art, everything from David Octavius Hill, early about 1844, on up to the latest work. And Sheeler looked very wise for a moment and then said, isn't it astonishing how photography has advanced without improving. which actually is perhaps not really fair to say, but some of the early photographs have an extraordinarily high level mm-hmm. of art quality. And
have there been any innovations then, to your mind, despite what the quote that you just used?
Well, there have been. One of the points that we were mentioning in just a casual conversation with the problem of making photography so simple that it takes no brains and no effort to mm-hmm. produce an image.
Is this good or bad?
It's very bad for the art of photography, but it's very good for the diarist approach.
Mm-hmm.
Diary now is a small camera, and the processing is done for them. But there isn't any reason, again, why any particular kind of photography couldn't become a deep art expression.
Mm-hmm.
Entirely the way it is used and what it is used on. Remember the earliest days, say in the 1870s, Jackson, O'Sullivan, and other members of the Rady group used ponderous glass plates. And they had to coat the plates in the field mm-hmm. and expose them while they were wet. That was called the wet plate process. And the exposures were very long, and then they would take the plate back into this little darkroom tent and process it. And the thought of packing these tons of equipment and glass plates through the mountains of the West still frightens me, but some wonderful pictures resulted. And then, of course, the next step was the dry plate, which could be exposed and developed at any convenient time later on. Then came the film. I think George Eastman was the pioneer in that. And following the first film, which was just quite ordinary in its color sensitivity, we had orthochromatic film, then we had panchromatic film, and then we have high speed films and fine grained films, and then of course the Polaroid process was invented, and that's quite a miraculous.
It's interesting though, you talked about the techniques of photography and how little they had changed in terms of what the artist can see, but the mechanical end of it has certainly come a long way. When we next talk to Mr. Adams, whose current exhibit of 40 Years of Photography is now at the De Young Museum, we'll talk about some of the new mechanics of photography. And since Mr. Adams did quote an authority on the subject, we're going to ask him how accurate some of his quotes are in regard to his credo and technique and so forth that I have here in front of me. Mr. Adams, we were briefly talking the last time about the mechanics of photography, and you had traced rather quickly for me the various processes that had been used in developing pictures. The idea of the Polaroid, so very, very quick to use. I guess they have electric eyes on them now, which will determine how much light the shutter needs, and then there's a 50-second process, and they're even doing it in color. What has this done to the art of photography?
Well, a lot of people were worried about it, but the worries are completely unfounded because, as I said before, if the intention of the photographer is to create art, then he can do so with any medium he chooses. The Polaroid process is, of course, a silver diffusion process, and the aesthetic feedback potentials of the medium are tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Have you used Polaroid?
Yes, I've used it for years. In fact, I've served as consultant for them for mm-hmm. 10 years and tried lots of the new materials out and worked out, expressed my ideas and able to prove and disprove things in the field. And
well, in the advertising of it, you'll hear words like miraculous and so forth.
Well, it is.
Is it?
Yes, it is, especially the new color process.
Mm-hmm.
It's something which I suppose, like all great inventions, is basically simple once it's done. But it took a terrific intuitive imagination to conceive of the process and then to make the equipment and set up the manufacturing system.
All right, the techniques. You being in this particular field for so long, have they ever occurred to you that it could be done this way? You talked about the manufacture and the technical genius that went into it, but the actual process itself, the theoretical aspects of how it would work, have they occurred to you and other photographers through the years?
Well, I think all of us had known that there was such a thing as the silver diffusion process, but of course it was very difficult to control. I would say that, no, I don't think anybody conceived of the Polaroid process as mm-hmm. it now is. I think this was possible to make a diffusion transfer picture, but certainly not on an amateur level, or mm-hmm. even a professional level. It would have been a laboratory experiment.
All right. If we said someone invented the Polaroid process, could we give one man the credit for it?
Oh, yes. It's Dr. Land. That's mm-hmm. what you call the Polaroid Land.
Mm-hmm. Did he have help, or did he work on this almost by himself?
Well, he's one of the greatest minds of our time, and he always has help, but he has always been the directing influence.
Mm-hmm.
It's his imagination that has created these things, and he's an extremely advanced thinker. Many of his assistants, strangely enough, instead of being chemists or physicists, are art students,
mm-hmm.
because he claims that the element of imagination is tremendously important, something of this kind.
In some of your early works in which you did the photographing in the Yosemite, if you had had a Polaroid Land camera at that time, would you have used it? And number two, could you have gotten the same results that you did achieve?
Well, again, it's awfully hard to say. If the Polaroid process had been available at that time, I'm quite sure I would have used it.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, there were so many different ways or different styles of this process. And a lot of people do not realize you have the ordinary rolled film and the new cameras film pack. Then you have the 4x5 system, which goes on standard cameras, or fit standard cameras. And then you have the new 4x5, what they call the Type 55, which gives you a negative of extremely fine quality.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that if in 1923 we could get the Type 55 film, I certainly would have used it, and I think I could have done some very quite remarkable things with it.
Are there any serious photographers that you know of who are still rejecting the idea of the Polaroid camera and will not use it, or are they as liberal as you are in your thinking and giving it credit when credit is due?
I think a tremendous number of people are using it. Many color photographers use the 4x5 system to study their setups. Now they have color in the 4x5, so then they have a much more precise control.
Mm-hmm.
Certain things, of course, can't be done. You can't make a 10-foot enlargement from a 35-millimeter negative.
Mm-hmm.
And certain things in the Polaroid process that just don't work out as well so far as with the some of the standard processes.
All right. Now, I hate to be this mechanical in the subject of photography, but in terms of equipment and so forth, is there any ultimate that one would look for in terms of an all-purpose camera? In your own work, which cameras in your own collection do you rely on most?
Well, I think the creative photographers of my type who work in the natural scene have to use, to a great extent, the view camera, which has all the adjustments, controlling focus and distortion, depth of field, interchangeability of lenses, and so on. On the other hand, I have a Hasselblad with four lenses. I get along very fine with that. I have a Zeiss Contorex with four lenses, 35 millimeter. But each one of these cameras has a certain adaptability that can be used for a certain purpose. And it's almost impossible, for instance, to do architectural work without a view camera, because you need such things as rising front and swing backs and all the things to control the image. On the other hand, working with nature and some like water or in sports, human activity, the 4x5 cameras are rather ponderous and uncomfortable instrument to use.
How about motion picture cameras and that particular art form? Have you ever dabbled in it?
No, I never.
Have you ever been inclined to do
yes,
so?
Yes, I've thought of it lots, and I have used a camera, but never very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
It's a separate world in itself. It's another form of art.
Well, speaking of your world, I have one of the things I enjoy doing is to, since we talk to so many people through the course of the weeks, is to read material that have supposedly been put out by them or things that they have said, and sometimes what the person actually said and what has been put in print fall far short of ever coming to a truthful line. We have here some statements by Ansel Adams, and in the next few minutes I like to test the reliability of the printed word. It says here, in terms of your credo, to photograph truthfully and effectively is to see beneath the surfaces. Impression is not enough. Design, style, technique, these two are not enough. Art must reach further than impression or self-revelation. First of all, did you say this?
Oh, yes. That's from the foreword of Portfolio 1.
Mm-hmm. These were things that you had actually written.
Oh, yes. Yes. If they're in quotes, they come from that.
They definitely come
these
from
these are taken from some of the writings.
How seriously do you intellectualize about your particular art?
Well, I don't intellectualize. I think one of the tragedies of a lot of contemporary art is that people are too self-conscious, serving too much as critics. They're trying to combine the quality of the critic with the quality of the artist at the same time. Now, that doesn't mean you can't be highly critical of your work. But the creative artist, I think, has to completely trust his intuition.
Mm-hmm.
And if he begins to intellectualize, the edge is taken off this vision. And I've seen it happen time after time with other people, and I know it's happened to me, that the intuitive perceptions of things and the visualization of a photograph is based on experience. And you just have to trust it. And then when it's all over, then you can evaluate it and see where you missed. But I'm one that find it very difficult, if not impossible, to verbalize about my pictures.
All right, we won't verbalize about your pictures.
No, I mean, I meant not in this sense, but in trying to explain in words what a picture means
yes.
as a photograph.
Can I ask you about the 400 pictures that are on exhibit at the Young Museum? Are you perfectly satisfied that they represent truly 40 years of hard work?
I think Mrs. Newhall, that's Nancy Newhall, who's the wife of Beaumont Newhall, who's director of George Eastman House in Rochester. She's a writer, artist in her own right, has an absolute genius for arranging exhibits, planning, designing, installing. And I think that this is probably as fine a job as could possibly have been done in a complete presentation. There are a few holes in the work, but I don't think there's any consequence. A few omissions.
You know, when you hear broadcasts like this and something is singled out, you'll immediately find people gravitating towards it at the exhibition. Are there any particular works that you're especially proud of? And you would like a good part of our listening audience to pay attention to.
Well, that's awfully hard to say, and I think the way Mrs. Newhall has planned the show, almost everything in it has its own individual importance.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's always a few photographs that I think I might like better than others, but I'm quite sure of this, that I could never have put this exhibit together myself.
How important is that exhibit in the placement? I mean, the picture is the thing, I would assume, and yet you have spent a great deal of time giving credit to the placement.
Oh, well, it is tremendously important, because not only do you have to think of the general visual feeling of a room or a wall, but your photographs have to flow. That is, there's a passage from one photograph to another in tone quality and design and size. And we lay out 6 or 8 prints for a certain wall space and start juggling them, and suddenly they fall into place. Perfectly obvious, that's the only way they could be. And then the eye of the mind can go from one to the other with a minimum of resistance, you see.
I sure remember that, Mr. Adams, when I go to view your exhibition at the de Young Museum. Our guest, by way of recording, has been the outstanding photographer Ansel Adams, and an exhibit of Mr. Adams' work currently on display through December the 8th at the de Young Museum here in San Francisco.
Remember to follow the News Vault from KCBS Radio on social media. On Facebook, we're at News Vault Podcast. On Twitter, find us at News Vault SF. On Instagram, we're at News Vault. Until our next episode, you are leaving the News Vault from KCBS Radio.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.